So I'm gonna go ahead and start. Hi.
Welcome.
So I'm gonna actually just kind of go quickly review the first 3 days.
Thank you.
The first day we actually just kind of dipped our pinky toe into the water kind of thing. But what I really wanted to emphasize, I've kind of come up with a Bible verse for each of these, but the idea of God as the fountain of living waters is just the source of strength in our lives. And the idea, we had everybody kind of write down what they thought about water. And, you know, what I wanted to leave people with in terms of thinking about water is that it's precious. You know, we don't have an alternative to water. Last I checked, that was kind of the substance our bodies and things were based off of. Come on in if you want to. This is the water thing. And we need it. It's finite. There's only so much water at any one period of time. It's renewable. It renews itself. It comes back again and again. It's very forgiving that way. And it's also, for lack of a better word, karmic. How we treat this resource definitely depends on how quickly and in what ways it comes back to serve our needs for life. I introduced the idea of scarcity and abundance. I should have introduced myself. My name is Greg McLaughlin. I work with an organization called Washington Water Trust, and I work throughout eastern Washington to restore stream flows in salmon-bearing streams by cooperating with farmers and tribes and municipalities. So working through some of these water conflicts is a lot of what I do. I did my graduate work on social ecology, which I'll talk about a little bit later. I was talking to Wayne yesterday, and he had a really good point. It's like, why would God have, you know, 97% of the water in the world, you know, locked up in salt and in somewhat unusable form and only leave us 3%? You know, so we're having this interesting discussion. And, you know, my response was, well, maybe God wants us to learn how to work together. And certainly the idea of scarcity and abundance. In my work, I realized that there's an abundance of water. What's scarce is the human ability to manage it well and to manage it well with each other. So scarcity or abundance depends on these choices we make in relationship with the fountain that gives us life. Water connects us to nature, to God, to creation. We are water and God is our fountain. And the point of these sessions is to ask the question, how are we tending the fountain? So the second day we talked about conflict in water. And to talk about some of the reasons for that, I thought in Psalm 63, God, my soul thirsts for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. This day was definitely based on why there is scarcity, why there are places where water is in such low demand, in such low supply. I was not able to talk so much about some of these global places in other parts of the world. I'll spend a little bit of time on that today, though. What I offered for discussion is that if we look at our culture and the way we look at resources, resources are external to our economic models. Nature is external. Resources are valuable to our economic models in so much as we can extract economic value out of them. But in terms of this idea of keeping the resource, of maintaining the ability of the fountain to flow, there's some things working against us and some of our economic models that create a temptation to diminish the quality and the flow of these resources around us. I compared a couple different perspectives on resource use and also water use. One which I called a subsistence perspective, that Ron Rudy, is that how you say the last name? Yeah, has been talking a lot about. And it's the idea of you're basically beholden to whatever God gives you, to whatever water flows and whatever the resource provides, you know. So these cultures that hunted and fished and used the water and moved around according to where the resources were would be this culture that really thought of water as a source of graceful provision. I actually had an opportunity to live in a community in southern Colorado that used to be part of Mexico and was historically had been part of the Mexican land grants. And the interesting thing about that community is that they managed their water according to a watershed. It was really a communally based management system, much like things work here at Holden. The idea is that water was extracted, utilization was extracted out of the water in terms of irrigation, livestock grazing, and water for homes. But what it was valued for was the ability to provide for the collective. Now we get to our system, which I'm calling the modern European perspective. And again, water being used to maximize economic values. An important part of that is it being privatized into individual ownership. This should be very familiar. It's our economic system. In some ways, it's what folks like John Locke and Adam Smith had in mind, especially Adam Smith, when he wrote The Wealth of Nations. There's some things that Adam Smith wrote that we don't pay attention to, but that's another discussion for another day. But water is controlled subservient to us. It's valued for its ability to serve the wealth of the individual. And it requires a lot of laws. I talked a lot about water law in the West, which I won't do today, but just suffice it to say, when we have an aggressively defined private property rights, there's the risk of somebody else taking those from us. And that requires a lot of government and a lot of laws. And that's why we have so many laws around water, is to protect private property. So then I started talking about this idea of the human ecosystem. If you haven't been here, or I'm passing around this. You've seen this, right? So I'm passing around, and we'll talk about this later. When you go to ecology class in high school or college or whatever, and ecology is a very new discipline, it's really only this idea of nature being this series of systems and water cycles and nitrogen cycles and food webs and all of it being dependent was something that maybe 50 or 60 years ago people started talking about, as a sort of three or four dimensional kind of concept. But even at that time and up until maybe 10 or 20 years ago, the idea that humans are part of that system was not discussed. And a lot of our environmental problems, I believe, stems from the fact that when we looked at the ecosystem, we were not including the impacts of humans or the participation of humans. The example I gave before is, it's not like we're aliens from another country living in a bubble and having spaceships, provide resources for us. There's an incredible amount of interaction, in fact, very key interaction. We are capable of altering it and impacting the environment more than any other species on Earth. So it makes sense for humans to be included in that. The other thing I talked about is how we define problems and how defining problems leads to whether a problem ends up in conflict or whether it ends up in something that's resolvable. And then thinking of individual values versus collective values, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. That's my son 5 years ago, eating from the tree of life. So the next thing was how the West is being won for water. So I'm really talking about, we're learning a little bit about why there's conflicts. We're learning how to get beyond the conflicts. And here's a couple of, can you guys read that from there? I had to fit a lot on these slides. Does somebody want to read that Isaiah quote up there?
When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongues fail for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in desolate heights, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water.
So in Isaiah, we have this promise of abundance. We have this 3% is enough. statement that's referred to in the Bible in the fountain. And then the next question is, how? How then shall we live as humankind? So does somebody want to read the Matthew verse? It should be pretty recognizable.
Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself."
So I put this, I'm trying to put these biblical references in there because it's partially because that's the audience, but partially because I think that it provides us a lot of wisdom in terms of understanding conflicts around these resources and how we're going to resolve them. Again, from before, seeds of conflict in these issues, it has to do with separating ourselves or thinking of ourselves outside of ecological systems, which just plain isn't true. And then poor management of the resources that results from that leads to scarcity. That has to do, I believe, with the first and greatest commandment, which is revering the fountain, revering the source of life in our world, and understanding that we're a part of that. We have a connection and perhaps a responsibility to creation. The second is defining our well-being separately from the well-being of our neighbors. And as I'm going to discuss in a minute, part of creating long-term solutions to conflict has to do with not just looking at our own self-interest and what we want, but finding out who's involved in the issue, whose values are important, who the stakeholders are, and fighting for what they want too, loving our neighbors as ourselves. So in the human ecosystem model, which you have a version of it, and this was developed by a guy named Gary Maclis, M-A-C-H-L-I-S, and has been adapted into lots of things. But the main human values and human institutions impacting and interacting with the ecosystem. And we're really trying to quantify and discuss and create a human ecosystem or a systems science that's based on that. And part of that, which comes from the political spectrum, is this idea of problem definition, defining the problem. You see in people, when people run for office all the time, this problem definition. They're always defining the issue. They're always defining the problem. Well, the problem is, the problem is the 1%, or the problem is Obamacare, or the problem is this, or the problem is that. How you define the problem is a very political act, and it also goes a long way towards deciding whether how you solve the problem is going to lead to conflict or resolution. When I think about defining the problem, I think about this idea that our shared water resources are not serving our shared values. There's people and values and things like that being left out. There's streams that are dried out instead of this recurring fountain. Defining a solution involves including everybody with a stake in the problem, incorporating their values, finding out what their values are, focusing on shared interests as opposed to our own interests, and building trust from everybody involved by doing stuff. I don't know how many people here have been to those meetings. You've given up a perfectly good, Friday night, go to some meeting at your church or your community, and it's just a bunch of people talking for 2.5 hours and nothing ever happens, and you're like, what a waste of time. So we need to value each other's time and actually do things. I talked about real versus symbolic conflicts. This is important because a lot of times people are fighting over things. The example I gave yesterday was my parents and the ice tray debates. My parents, I remember one time getting into an hour-long argument about the correct way to fill and remove ice from the ice trays in the freezer. And I won't go into the detail of who thought what, but the story is that their conflict with each other had absolutely nothing to do with ice trays. And this happens a lot in all of our relationships. We project something else into the discussion that has nothing to do with solving the problem. So we have real conflicts sometimes. We have them in our relationships. And this is really what I'm talking about, is a series of relationships about how we manage resources. But we have to focus on where the real conflicts are as opposed to the symbolic conflicts. And then voluntary participation and advocating aggressively for this common interest, for these this picture of shared values. Of this is the story that we can tell about our shared resource that meets everybody's needs, and we're all going to fight for that. I'm going to fight for your stake in it, you're going to fight for my stake in it, and that we all sort of end up on the same team. So I talked about some case studies of the organization I worked with. What we do is we put water in stream as a beneficial use, which basically says that it's just like if you irrigate or graze for livestock or create power, having water in stream for salmon is beneficial and important use. It protects the water right, and it also gives us means to provide economic incentives to the people and the partners that we work with. We work amongst partners who hate each other, tribes and local communities and environmentalists and irrigators, government, and, you know, local government, state government, but it's a constant effort to define the problem and define the shared interests and define the shared values that are in these places. And it involves a lot of crossing boundaries. I'm trying to like pull other people's things into this. Julia's series has been about crossing boundaries. So it's really about going and talking to this person who's a stakeholder, who's somebody that I don't agree with, and I know they don't agree with me, but finding out who they're, what they're about, and realizing that their community is a part of my community. And then if we're going to work to resolve the water issue, then we have to do that. So we're working towards projects that restore salmon runs, maintain agricultural production. So this is the human ecosystem model, which you have a copy of. And so what I have talked about in this is values, resources, and institutions. Resources would basically be the structural ecosystem of energy flows between nature and animal communities and all those things. The values and institutions would be how we uniquely interact with that system as a human society. And we work as then on values. We have values of economic interest, there's values of security, of cultural identity, conservation is a value. So values are human constructs of like, okay, this is what we want to pull out of this. This is what's important to us individually. And institutions are the stakeholders, are the people and the forces that can be that can interact with nature, with water in this situation. Introduce this idea of social capital. Really, it's another word for community, but social capital is that ability and the power of people working together or working to exercise their own influence or interest in something that can be a pretty powerful resource. So what you're looking to do in all these situations is move, identify where the conflicts are. You know, really focus on the real ones, not the symbolic conflicts when you're looking at values. And then look towards building trust around these shared values, and that's where these win-win solutions come from. I don't know if any of you have been involved in the last few years in a strategic planning process of some sort. Has anybody done this? Okay. So what's one of the things? Did you go through a value definition exercise as part of that? Does anybody remember doing that? So what happened with that? What was the context?
I'm talking about healthcare.
Okay.
And trying to get stakeholders.
Uh-huh.
And it's an issue that's so easily devolves into politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was to be able to come to the fact that we all need to be healthy, to lead good lives. And so then what comes out of that is maybe something as diverse as bike paths.
Mm.
And then if you have a bike path, you have to make sure that it's a safe bike path. So it can talk about things around gang prevention or whatever. But then the very be more familiar about being healthy is obesity and tobacco cessation. And that all around the idea that the healthier we are, the healthier the community. And the community has to be healthy to make a healthy individual. So that involved many more stakeholders if we concentrate on that value.
And the thing that's
unlikely allies.
The thing that's really, that's a great example is healthcare. I mean, talk about a divisive political issue in our country. But what they did is they looked at shared values. They said, you know, this is something that's important to all of us, you know, and let's not have a symbolic debate about it, but let's look at what our real shared problems are and do something about it. Imagine a national health care debate that happened along those lines.
There's I belong to a grassroots organizing, and there are some principles about which we go under. And one of the primary principles is no permanent allies, no permanent enemies, only permanent values.
Yes.
Well, I just wanted to ask your sense, and I mean, I'm sure you got more examples than I do, is the conflict between conservation and economic development real or symbolic?
It's symbolic. I believe it's symbolic.
So what would it mean to make that, to focus?
Jobs versus owls, you know, that's the...
It's a false dilemma.
That's a false, right. I mean, tell me about, so what do you mean by a false dilemma?
Really deep, but personally I think that we've been mired in some form of supply side, aka horse and sparrow economics for decades, and we're destroying our demand for manufacturing by destroying everybody's jobs, and therefore nobody's buying anything, therefore there could be all these jobs if we did things a little differently. And green, you know, building windmills is you're making a product out of metal that can be recycled again later. It may not be the most efficient thing in the world, but it doesn't matter that it's efficient. Efficiency isn't all that critical. It isn't as important as they say it is.
Well, and so that I think a lot of what you're describing too is that when we look at some of these big values and these issues, maybe we're bereft. The only thing we're bereft of is creativity and the ability to look through that. You know, I don't separate nature from economics because I think nature is economics. You know, I remember when I was going out to grad school in Connecticut, and I'm driving around, and I grew up in Missouri, and they're not producing anything there. I mean, there's like forests and forests, and there's no farms, and there's no factories, and there's no anything, and yet it's the wealthiest state in the country. I'm like, well, what do they do? Well, you go up to Hartford, and there's these big insurance buildings, you know. Well, they sell security is what they do. They sell human security, you know, which is a human value. But the idea is that everything that we do, every penny that was originally made in our country came from resources, came from nature, the fountain. This is what all of our economic well-being comes from. And we share that benefit, we share that bounty from the world around us. This is why I'm saying we're a part of that. You know, and so it's, you know, I couldn't believe it when I went to college and all these people were talking about how, like, against the environment farmers were. And I was like, I grew up in Missouri and, you know, the farmers who aren't good stewards are not farmers anymore. They're overworking it for somebody else or at the Eveready factory or something because they messed up their land. And, you know, so I don't see these big divide or differences. I see the commonalities, and I believe that nature and the resources of nature is definitely a resource that we all have a shared interest in protecting. And I mean, if you look at the values that are kind of going to some of these resource issues, economic development, jobs, conservation, wildlife, aesthetic beauty, recreation opportunities, I mean, how many people do you know that are opposed to any of these values? I mean, this is what we enjoy doing as humans. We like to work and make a living and have security financially and aesthetically for our future generations. We like to see fishing come to places like Golden. You know, we want to know that the people in our communities are going to be able to have work to do and have things to, I mean, there's nothing divisive about this. So, but there's the idea of scarcity. There's an idea of degradation. I think a really important one, which again is a whole other session, is access, fair access to the resources. I think that, you know, the reason that these ideas of justice are important to me, or one of the reasons I think we might be important to everybody, is that people who are cut off from things don't not need them anymore. They still need them. But when they go about getting those things that they need, it happens to be in very inefficient ways that degrade the pie, that make the pie smaller, either through crime or instability of communities or inefficiencies. So having access, I think, is really important, and that's a resource, access to a resource. So we're looking for solutions that expand the pie. Conserving resources, this is important. Not because of some value of save the earth, but because we're connected to this. You know, it comes back. This is what we feed off of as a species. And then equalizing access through shared agreements. And then again, we need to evolve our institutions. I'm going to go back to the dysfunctional meetings that we've all been involved in. And the dysfunctional meetings are happening for a few reasons. You know, one is that there's somebody or more people in there with a very narrow agenda. They just want to get their own thing out of that meeting and go home. You know, sometimes those people happen to be running the meeting. The second thing that happens in bad meetings is that people don't know how to run efficient meetings. It's poor leadership. You know, another thing that happens in bad meetings is that there's poor access to information. People don't have all the information that they need to make decisions. And then there's poor leadership, and there's poor conflict resolution skills. I think that institutions is a skill. Like, running good organizations and good institutions is really a skill. One of the things you got to do is get the selfish, narrow agendas out of the process. You have to be an advocate for the common interest. And really focus on mutual agendas, mutual problem solving, collective problem solving. In the water world, we think about cooperative funding, we think about watershed-based planning, you know, when we think about advancing a common interest. Memorandums of agreement between things. What we do is kind of make these cooperative agreements between parties that don't like each other. And then you articulate and implement these mutual problems and solutions, and you do stuff, and you articulate how this is serving everybody's needs and build these partnerships around that. So we're looking to do things like that, and I would say that anytime you have a conflict or a scarcity or, you know, a problem in an area that doesn't seem to be resolvable, it's probably because of what I very conveniently organized using subliminal messaging into red and green. And red is bad and green is good, of course, so at least I admitted it. But when we think about things in scarcity and we get bogged down in conflicts, especially that aren't related to the problem, and when we allow narrow agendas at the margins to come in and hijack the common agenda, we're going to have problems, and we're having problems that are resolvable because we haven't dealt with that. Moving towards abundance is about building trust around shared values. It's about thinking about my neighbor down the street and showing respect for them even though they're different than me, crossing that boundary. And it's about seeing ourselves as part of the system. So today, I'm talking about the future of water. And this is one of the things that, of course I went to Revelations. I couldn't resist. You know, Revelations is all about, well, what will happen if we do this or we don't do that? And, you know, I decided to focus on the hopeful messages in Revelations. There's some not so hopeful ones about the Euphrates drying up and, you know, whatnot. But wow, there's some amazing stuff in there. You know, to him who overcomes, I will give eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. This is a return to the garden. You know, the future of our species in some ways, if you look at it at a very spiritual level, we, and this this is something Ron was talking about, is when we exited the garden and we took this cultural path of becoming people who extracted and took things from nature and took things from God and privatized it to ourselves and killed off the people who tried to take it from us or passed laws to protect us from them, you know, versus really an acceptance and an openness and an acquiescence to grace. You know, so we left the garden, we got kicked out of the garden because we wanted to use things beyond the fountain's capacity to continue to, I mean, I believe maybe we even destroyed the garden. And then we go out and the garden comes back. The water cycle returns. We get more stuff and we destroy that. And then it comes back. Wow, is God forgiving? You know? But in the future, who knows? But, you know, it's really this invitation to come back into the garden that's always open. And I think that's a uniquely spiritual idea that is very related to our environmental work that we do. And then this picture of a river of life proceeding from the throne of God. I mean, the images in this, I think, could not be more clear about, you know, I've been sort of kind of wrestling with this question of what does Christianity have to say about nature? You know, what's, you know, what kind of language is there? You know, I've been asking myself that this week and trying to sort that out because I've kind of come up with this idea that, wow, maybe the images aren't that strong for us. But this is great. I mean, there's like here we are in the middle of the street. There's a river on every side, and the tree of life, again, the tree of life is back. We're back in the garden, and every month of the year, it's providing for us. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So in the story of us healing the environment, we're learning two things. We're learning to rever God, rever creation, and we're learning to give a crap about each other. You know, I think it kind of comes together pretty nicely when we look at some of those things. Climate change, I promised to talk about climate change and population growth. And I'm talking about that in the context of this Red Queen hypothesis, which I'll get to later. But it's not going to get any easier. Looking at North America and the water issue with the ideas of things being scarce, Western mountains will have less snowpack. It's already happening. And I went to, when I was growing up in Missouri, we go out to Colorado to a place called St. Mary's Glacier. Has anyone ever heard of St. Mary's Glacier? Well, probably nobody's going to ever hear of it again because it's gone. And I have a picture of me at about, I'm not that old, you know, I don't feel that old, but I have a picture of me as a 9-year-old boy walking up this field of ice in August. And the only thing in the picture is me and white. And the glacier is entirely gone. These glaciers up here are on their way. Take a picture. Hike up to them, get a picture while you can. So the snowpack will increase, reduce summer flows. The water's going to come down quicker. You know, we're going to get a whole bunch of water in the spring, and then in August and September, less and less water. Obviously, fish and everybody else needs water 12 months out of the year. You know, the tree is a tree for each month of the year. So we're going to have that issues. We're already seeing issues with trees, you know, pest problems with trees in the North American forest. If any of you have been to Colorado or Wyoming or even Utah or getting into Washington, there are entire forests that are basically disappearing to pine beetles. And the models about climate change are basically saying, well, that's going to be really good for the pine beetles because they're not going to die off in the winter. We're not going to have these really cold winters that creates these kills. Increase in the number, intensity, duration of heat waves. Further challenging cities who already experience heat waves with health impacts. Older populations are most at risk, which we already know. Whenever you see the thing about the drought here or there, it's usually people who are older, probably economically disadvantaged, that are the ones that don't make it. That was the good news. What I want to do is now go to other places, because the impacts of climate change in places like Africa are just devastating. And they talk about the climate change coming, and there's already existing stresses on this place, existing poverty, existing political conflicts, and degradation of the ecosystem. And you know, it's going to move the line over. You're going to have expanded areas of drought. Most parts of Africa are going to become less fertile and more bereft of water. They say by 2050, which is certainly within my lifetime, and it's going to be about the time that my kids are my age, between 350 and 600 million people are projected to experience increased water stress due to climate change. I mean, I don't care if folks, what folks think about environmentalism, a political issue, or things like that, but I really wish people would start thinking about climate change as a humanitarian issue, because that's what this is about. Compromised agricultural production. This is a good example of a shared problem. You know, and again, I go back to this question of access. What do people who have poor access to resources, what we consider fair or just access to resources, do to get it? Asia. Oh, I don't know what happened here, sorry. This is supposed to be Asia. I'm not sure what happened to that. Anyway, Asia is a similar thing. In fact, the numbers are even higher because of population densities in Asia. By the 2050s, these increased demands from on freshwater resources from climate change are projected to reach a billion people. Increased flooding, threatened coastal areas. The next slide, I'll talk about it. Crop yields could increase up to 20% in East and Southeast Asia. It's interesting, with climate change, some parts of the world will actually increase production. Canada, the Northern Plains, are probably going to have increased agricultural yields as a function of climate change. At the same time, yields could decrease up to 30% in Central and Southeast Asia, which is basically India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, parts of China. Really where about a third of the world lives. Sickness and death, disease, and to understand how this happens or why this happens, this is Bangladesh. And I don't think I'd be talking about Bangladesh if I hadn't. I actually went there for a day. I got a cheap plane ticket from Bangkok to Kathmandu, and it involved, it's $250, which is great, round trip, but I spent the night in Dhaka, and it was just completely overwhelming, the amount of poverty that was just visible from the van, just to see it, just to see what was going on there. The red indicates areas of Bangladesh that will probably be inundated by water if climate change and sea levels continue to rise at their present levels. The darker red indicate, or the darker colors, whether they're red or green, indicate population densities. So it's kind of hard to see because I had to blow this up. I didn't want to download a big file. But the darker ones are basically places where there are more than 1,000 people living every square kilometer. A square kilometer is about, I think, 100 acres? Maybe, no, what is it? A square mile is how many acres? 640? Is that right? Or about that? Okay. So a square kilometer is about half of that. So maybe 250 acres or something like that, or 300 acres. But there's more than 1,000 people living per square kilometer. And these people are going to go somewhere. They're probably going to try to go to Pakistan or India. Which, if you look at, or China, they're bordered on the other side by Burma. So there's a lot of great opportunities for these folks. I mean, imagine you're sitting there with your family and your child is being inundated, and the rice paddies that your family would have are now salinized because of the seawater rise, which is already happening in many places. And you're like, well, I could go to Pakistan with my kids, or I could go to Burma with my kids. Maybe I could figure out a way to get into China or India. You know, but these are the kind of choices that are happening for people. So this is why I brought up this idea of a Red Queen principle. And it's actually an evolutionary system principle, which is the idea that, you know, in order for a species to maintain its fitness, it has to, among the systems it's being co-evolved with, it needs to continually adapt. And so it's from the Through the Looking Glass, and where Alice is running the same place and not getting anywhere, and he's like, well, you have to run twice as fast to get anywhere else if you want to get somewhere else. But this is actually a biological principle. And the reason I bring this up is because you could say, well, it's about humans surviving, you know, and so it's like, you can make the case that our ability to extract in this sort of selfish way is very Darwinistic. You know, we're going to survive at the expense of other species, because they do say fitness amongst relative fitness. You know, that's us compared to other people. But, I mean, my argument is that we've already won that race. We've already kind of established who's in charge here. That ain't going to change. We're competing with each other and against a finite system of provision at this point. It's not about these other species. It's actually about ours. And so that's where I go back to Revelation. The revelation for me is that all these things connect back with our ability to survive. We've been given this tree. We've been given this Garden of Eden. We've been given the invitation to go back into it. But it depends on our ability to incorporate nature as not an externality. It's not something over here. We're not going into nature just like people go into church. People go into church and like, okay, I'm going to keep God over here in my life. Hey, God, you're great. All right, see ya. You know, and then 6 days a week go over here. I mean, this is how a lot of people experience church. I know I experience church sometimes that way myself. But to say, look, this is... I mean, it's stupid to do that, because that's not really what happens. You know, we're a part of each other's lives. We're a part of nature. Nature is a part of us. And then also to say, to learn how to value the people around us. Yeah, it's complicated. Wow, what do you do about all the starving people in Africa or in Bangladesh or, you know, or in that other side of the tracks in the town that we grow up in? Why should we care? And yet that's what we're called to do. I believe why we're called to do that, it's because our very survival depends on it. So that's all I have to say. We can do one of two things. We can, I said that we could go through this human ecosystem model and actually come up with a couple of examples. Or we could just open it up to questions. I'm fine with either one.
So what do you think the chances are of us thinking collectively for our common good? From the experiences you've had?
Well, I think that, I believe that one of the things we need to become advocates for is this idea of a common good. It's really easy for us. I mean, you know, I'm an example of this. I got out of college, I was a rabble-rouser. You know, I believe nothing more than we should have as much preserved wilderness as possible. If I have to go stand in front of a bulldozer to make it happen, by golly, I have a right to do that, you know? And, you know, because that was what I cared about. And it wasn't working. You know, we were losing the war with the environmental things. It was only when I started to say, okay, here's this farmer who owns water, and they're the ones that are using this resource that also I have a stake in. You know, am I going to be better off starting to take him to court or putting, you know, sugar in his tractor or, you know, any of those things? Or am I going to be better off sitting down with him and finding out what he likes and working together? That's what we do. You know, work I've done has kept, I can think of four farming families that the work that me or one of my coworkers done has kept in business. They would have gone under. They would be out working at the Ever Ready factory, you know, and they're in streams that were dry that now have salmon runs back in them. So I know it's possible. I have seen more progress happen with this than I ever did when, you know, I was around all the people that were doing eco-terrorist actions in the forest, which I've seen that happen too. And I've never seen that change anything.
How many people are there like you?
Not enough.
Well, I think there aren't a lot because of the way that science has taught ecology. And it's taught it in a vacuum from sociology or from policy. There hasn't, and they've always sort of occupied these different worlds. So I think that it's growing. I mean, I think more and more organizations are seeing that they're losing the war. You know, more and more farmers or whoever are seeing that it's not worth fighting about this stuff anymore, that there's a better way. But I hope we learn quickly, because we got some stuff around the corner that's not going to be very fun. Yeah.
What do you say? There's a growing number of people who literally believe that global warming is a hoax. And I run into them frequently in my line of work. What do you say to start a conversation without offending? Because people start getting upset when you disagree with them. Do you have any experience with this?
Well, I think that it's like a conflict there. You have a different perception of what's real than another person. You know, I'm not calling these people crazy, but I'm saying that whenever you're dealing with somebody who has mental health issues, you recognize that they're going to have this view of reality that it is what it is. You can't change it. You know, we have this idea that we're going to go and change all these people around us by having a conversation with them, and that's not going to happen. And unfortunately, some people have to experience these incentives for change, and maybe it'll happen with them and maybe it won't. But I think that those people aren't going to be a part of the solution, so you don't have to worry about them. You know,
fair enough. That's a good answer.
I don't ever, if somebody says, oh, I don't think global warming exists, you know, I think that, you know, that's their right to believe. People have a right to believe what they want to believe. I mean, I think what I'm focused on an audience is people who recognize, okay, something's maybe happening, but there's nothing we can do about it. You know, I think I'm trying to engage a discussion and show these pictures, you know, and understand that this is a humanitarian issue and there might be some really good reasons to do something. I think those are the people that are going to make stuff happen.
Greg, is your position, how is it funded? Is it through the state?
Well, we're a nonprofit, and we get money from the Bonneville Power Administration, who, most of our money, we get some from the state, but they manage all the dams. So whenever you want to relicense the big dam on the Columbia River, you have to show that you've mitigated for salmon. Because when they built all the big dams and killed off all the salmon runs, which got them crossways with the Endangered Species Act and the tribal treaties. So they can't relicense their dams and continue to give really cheap power to people in the Pacific Northwest unless people like us mitigate. And they need somebody who can go out and sit down at a coffee table in the kitchen with the farmer and, you know, get something done. So we have funding. But we spend ratepayers' money basically, just providing these on a grant basis.
Are there other nonprofits like you?
Well, sort of. I mean, if you think about the land trusts, like local land trusts or nature conservancy, I mean, I would say that, you know, we really do the same work. We just work with water rights to pieces of land. But Nature Conservancy has an interesting story because they went through this whole process of realizing the same thing. They were acquiring these lands, working with these farmers, realized that, you know, we can be really politically neutral, actually. We don't have to make some big bullhorn thing. And we can actually just work with people and find out, okay, there's this piece of land. Let's do something to conserve it and, you know, provide some incentives for them. So. Other organizations are trying to get there. It's hard when you have an agenda, you know, and it's part of your history is to have that agenda. You know, it's part of it means detaching from a very, you know, an outcome that you expect to happen.
I was wondering if you could summarize again for me the Red Queen theory or philosophy, because it, in my mind I'm going to go away thinking I have to work twice as hard just to keep it from getting worse. That's you must run at least twice as fast, okay, to get somewhere. So is that kind of what you're saying? It's like now's the time to apply ourselves as, you know, much harder than what we've applied ourselves to date.
Well, another way to look at it is that people want to do what they've done up to this point and how to fix all the problems. You know, I keep using examples of marital relationships, and I'm divorced, so you know, don't take my advice. But at the same time, I, you know, in the process of doing that, learned a lot about what not to do, and I think that there's a need for thinking about in relationships how do we recognize what we've done wrong up to this point, and acknowledge that, and own that, and say, you know, this is sort of what I need to do differently, because this is broken, you know. And until I take some responsibility for saying, okay, I'm going to try to do something different. I'm going to try to get out of my comfort zone. And so I think that's relevant, because anytime you get up to this point, and you know, you're at this point, and you look at the future, and it's like, I mean, what are we going to do? We're going to sit there and just be victims to life? We're going to say, oh, this always happens to me, or, well, there's nothing you can do about it anyway. You know, we can't do it. I mean, a lot of times what people are saying is that I don't want to be uncomfortable. I don't want to change what I've done or how I've done it. And we just went through this big process. It's our church, you know, defining values and saying, well, we got to change some things. And, you know, I mean, we had to do it because we thought we might have to close down. but we had to do it to survive. You know, we had to change.
What I'm hearing on the Red Queen theory is that we need to realize that we are running. We are running right now.
Yeah.
We are in the process of moving. It's just we have to move twice as fast as we are now. You know?
And what does that look like?
Oh, boy, I don't know. To me, I think that identifying the threats is one of the biggest things that I'm going to take away from here. Understanding that there are threats, what the threats are, and that I may be committing some of the threats. I may have my own narrow agenda.
Here's another good example of that. I won't bring it up because I'm just going to time. But if you think about population growth, and I include resource consumptive growth in that, because essentially that's really what matters. There's a mathematician that talked about this one time, about the idea of doubling time. You know, there's a doubling rate in population growth. So it's like you imagine a bunch of critters in a jar, and between like 11 o'clock at night and midnight, they're going to go from one organism to the jar being full. So at 11:59, how full is the jar?
Half full.
It's half full. So at 11:59, the minute before midnight, it doesn't even feel that full in there, you know? And so when you think about models that are showing that we're exponentially growing our resource consumption and our population growth, and does anybody know enough about economics? What happens if you have flat growth rates in an economic system?
Debt.
That's right. I mean, the economic system, as we know it, collapses. We have recession. Our economic system is built on a requirement of growth every year. That in some form of the economy has to grow every year, or our economic system will collapse. So that's another good example of that.
It will collapse. It can't keep going.
You know, flat growth, 0% growth. You know, if we don't have population growth or resource consumptive growth, if we don't continue to consume more and more and more every year, our economic system doesn't know what to do with that.
And we have to keep pulling it out of the ATM that is the environment.
And that there's a finite amount there. I mean, you know, it's just, we're beyond, like, talking about these issues of, you know, maintaining some pristine concept of our world, you know.
But see, at this point, I think you're saying that economic and environmental concerns are a real conflict.
They are a conflict, but in my humble opinion, here's where you say yeah, right? In my humble opinion, the fiats and laws surrounding the very system of money itself predetermines the conflict between the environment and the economy. Because this growth model wouldn't have to be there. The constant growth model is by design, not by mandate, or not by the way that God wants it, or not by the way that it would need to be for everybody to get what they want. It's designed by bankers for bankers.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. But I think we need to be able to say that's a real conflict. And then
well,
we've got to start imagining a different economic system that grows.
I still think that our economic system is everything around us. It's predicated on that. So I see a huge connection between that. I'm going to leave it before we go on a, anyway, I'll answer questions afterwards too, but I wanted that Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, so it's the foundation of our economic system, also wrote a lesser read piece called A Theory of Moral Imperatives. And within that, he warns about people that are abusing the common interest, that are basically, that there needs to be some sort of control of greed. He understood that we're all greedy and built Wealth of Nations is based on greed, but the theory of moral imperatives, says it's morally imperative that we control greed so that we don't have people that are taking for themselves at the expense of everybody else to subsist off the system. And that's if we don't do that, then the system's not going to work. We kind of ignore that, but you know, it's conveniently lost in the system. That, you know, yeah. Go ahead.
Within the Affordable Care Act, there is a thing called Community Transformation Grants. Have you heard of that?
No.
Oh, well, the idea of it is that it's like innovation grants, but it's the requirement is that stakeholders in the community come together, like I was saying before.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just curious if that's reflective of the of what you're talking about, is that's the attempt to find common good, and to the incentive is that money will be funded if the common good is about health. Does that reflect what you've been talking about? Is that a nice start? Is that a hopeful start?
I think that's a reflective thing, and I think that I'm thinking in terms of what works at this point. And it's not even like what should we do, but what works, you know. And I think that is it. I think that the people who participated in that are going to be really glad they did. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just want to say that State of Minnesota in 2008 voted to assess, utilize 2/3 of 1% of sales tax to develop a water framework for the state. And so doing, they selected Deborah Swackhammer from the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota to oversee this framework that was to be presented to the legislature, and it's a year ago, this past January, that happened. She collected and developed this framework of stakeholders, which included the input from citizens from the state, all the various state, federal agencies, MPCAs, whatever, in a whole year and a half, 2 year process. And so now we have 25 years to protect our 14,000 lakes, keep them clean or get them clean. And the whole the process seems to have worked pretty well. Organizing all these agencies and then getting the funds. Now that the citizens of Minnesota had to vote on this, 2/3 of those funds go to this water cleanup process. 1/3 went to arts and culture. Hmm. So it's called the Legacy Act, and anybody can Google it. And you can probably see the framework, but it's in process.
Well, yeah, I think those are good stories. I mean, I think what I found in this is that like, people are glad they did it, you know? I mean, I think that's what comes back to it. It's not, do I think they should do it? I mean, I want people to have a good life, you know? I care about people, so it's just, you know, this is why I think this stuff's important, you know? Because I think people have a right to a quality of life, and I think this is, it breaks my heart to see things get in the way of it that shouldn't. I can talk to folks afterwards. I know we kind of have to start half planning out because Ben's going to be in here. Ben? Yeah, right?
Jan, I think.
Oh, is it Jan?
The bookstore.
Oh, okay, well, Jan's going to be here next. And
yeah.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you.
Thank you.